Hi, everyone. This is Yin, and welcome to Growth and Failure. This show highlights extraordinary people that inspire and motivate me to level up. I'll have conversations with a wide range of profiles, from entrepreneurs and athletes, investors to educators, you name it. I love hearing people's different journeys. For me, the biggest lessons learned and opportunities to grow come from the struggle, the pain, the defeat. And I hope hearing these stories inspire you to not fear that messy middle or failure, but rather motivates you to reflect, to keep learning, and ultimately to keep growing. For more information, please visit growthandfailure.com for more updates, and please write a review if you can. They really do help other people find this show. Thanks for listening. This is the story of Rachel Klein, CEO of Firestarter Studios, a video production company producing a wide range of content, from animation to award-winning documentaries. In this episode, we cover Rachel's extraordinary career, starting out in production and spanning from HBO to producing UFC primetime and content on Showtime and Xbox Studios to starting her own studio, Firestarter Studios, about 8 years ago. Now, as you'll hear, Rachel is a burst of energy. And I'm inspired by her relentless pursuit to creating high-quality content and her drive to start her own studio that creates exceptional and unique content with an amazing subtitle, We Don't Make Cheap Shit. And I thoroughly enjoyed talking to her about the path that is clearly led by curiosity and a genuine interest in creativity and the arts and people. Please enjoy this interview with the Firestarter herself, the vibrant Rachel Klein. Hi, Rachel. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh my gosh. Thank you for joining. And a big thank you to Jess Ryan for introducing us. She's just an injection of energy. And I remember when she connected us, I was so grateful. I had a conversation with you and I realized, oh, no wonder she connected us. So thank you to her for that.
I'm happy to be here.
Now, before we talk about your incredible success now as the CEO of Firestarter Studios, and you have a whole list of really amazing places that you've worked with and brands that you've worked with, I'd like to rewind your very long highlight and sizzle reel all the way back, because my listeners really like to learn more about you and your childhood and where you grew up. So if you don't mind sharing where you did grow up.
It's kind of funny. I was born in New York City in Queens. And as I was growing up, I was telling everybody I was born at Lenox Hill in Manhattan. And I wasn't. Because like, I don't want to be from Queens, but I am. And then the story in my family goes that as soon as my mother could hear a New York accent, she grabbed my dad by the ear and said, we're going to Jersey, which if you can imagine was better than New York. But we landed right outside of Princeton and there's like no accent there. There's nothing there but Princeton University and some farmland at the time. That's where I grew up. Very integrated, great area, great family until it wasn't a great family and my parents split. And then I was raised, geez, I would say from like second grade on by a really badass single mom.
Love it. And so one thing I always like to fast forward to is college, because I'm so fascinated by people's careers as an adult and their professional journey. It all seems to come from college and this major that you have to pick when you're 17 or 18 and you choose this college that changes your whole life because it gives you this personal ecosystem with your friends in your 20s and sets you off on this professional path. But you realize nobody knows what they want to do when they're 17 or 18. And so I'm curious, how did you pick the college you went to and why? Was it Princeton? Because geographically you were close to there, but how did you pick your undergrad?
I think if I got into Princeton, my parents would have just died of a heart attack right there. That wasn't going to happen. I am the absolute opposite of everything you just said. I took 13 years to graduate college. I went to 5 universities. I had no idea what I wanted to do, but I knew I wanted to have a great time in my 20s and that time in my life would never come back. So I didn't put all that pressure on myself of, oh my God, must start job now, must start this now, must know these people now, must do internships now. I traveled the country and went to school wherever I landed, as opposed to picking a school. Now, out of high school, I have been very public about I have ADHD, so nobody ever really addressed it. So I had a very hard time even getting out of high school. So my options for college were very limited because nobody was dealing with that at that time. And so at the time, I did what probably half of your listeners did, which is follow a guy. I had a boyfriend who was like, I'm in music. I'm going to go to Brevard College in the middle of nowhere, North Carolina. As a Yankee, I was like, yeah, I'm going to go. It's going to be great. And then went down there and it was like as if I was on another planet. Just got complete culture shock, which was a huge lesson because I was calling my mom up in New Jersey and I was saying, I don't know how, you know, they're calling me a Yankee. I was like, how do they know I like the Yankees? She's like, oh my God, you're such an idiot. But I think instead of really focusing on just that time of my life being setting it up for the rest of my life, I just wanted to make sure that I had a great time doing what I was doing at that time. I learned a lot more in life learning than I did in school learning, which to this day, I still think was way more worth it than just college.
I love that. That's the longest I've heard for anyone getting an undergrad. So I don't know if there's an award for that, but kudos to you. And so from that, so 13 years, five universities, along the way, did you ever think, well, maybe I just won't finish my undergrad? Or did you know that you wanted to and just it would take a slow and steady time to finish it?
Never thought I wouldn't finish. Always knew I would. I have taken classes my entire life for something. I just love it. I am a complete teacher butt kisser. Love that feedback. Love you're top of the class. You're great. And at Brevard, I had a professor who was teaching an ethics class. And he's like one of those teachers out of the gate that said, nobody ever gets an A, which everybody walked out. Half the students just quit. And so I'm like, I said, a butt kissing teacher loving person decided that I was going to be the first A. And we had lots of oral arguments that had to happen in the class on certain topics. He was the one who actually said to me, bar none, you may be the first student to never get an A, but your testing sucks. Your oral arguments are perfection, but I can't understand what's going on between your brain and speaking and your brain and test taking. And he was the one who figured out that I had ADHD. So he taught me how to learn. So it went from something of a lifelong hatred to a lifelong learn. I love to learn. Now I want to learn everything, even about people, about subjects. I met you. I started reading more finance books. You told me a couple of books to read. I had to read them. And so it really, education for me was a pinnacle point in college to change my entire life for the better, rather than just steering me in a direction. You got good grades, so then what, you're going to be a lawyer? Not to say that's bad. My mom thought I should have been a lawyer, and actually she was right, if she's listening.
What an amazing encounter with this professor at Brevard. Do you still keep in touch with him?
I don't. And I really should kind of hit him up on the side and say, you're a rock star, man. After that, I actually ended up, when I did graduate, graduated summa cum laude with a 4.0. And then went on to grad school in New York City. So it turned into something horrible, into something that I understood that I wasn't stupid. It's a game changer.
That's incredible. So what did you end up studying on and focusing your research on?
I took my undergraduate in music business, thinking that that's an honest business. And so I started in concert promotions and was really great at it and loved it, but just did not like the industry at all. Didn't like the level of shadiness that I kept coming across. It just wasn't my thing. And so I decided to go back to school and go into entertainment, which I don't know how many steps above that was. And that's how I ended up in that way. Some people that I know, some of my friends, producers that I know, very big producers, I watched TV my whole life, or I started in the theater when I was 5 and I knew what I wanted to do. I didn't. And I just fell into these things accidentally. Actually, I was working at Starbucks one day and I just happened to say to another person that was behind the counter with me, man, I'd love to work on The Simpsons. And it turned out that one of my best customers that was standing over the counter was like, you know, I work at Fox, right? And I was like, what? Like, yeah, come in Monday. Let's talk. You're great. I love you. Let's find you a job. And so that spiraled into this really interesting career of me kind of bumbling through, not really knowing what there even was to do in television.
Well, so what was your first job in kind of the TV or production ecosystem? Because you said you started with concert promotion, but then when did it actually pivot away from music to more the role you're in today and more production?
Yeah, that job at Fox was my first gig. And it's funny because the woman who was across the counter who was like, you got to come on in. By the time I got in, she left and I got there and nobody knew I was there. And so the woman who took her place She is now one of my dearest friends on the entire planet. And she constantly makes fun of me because she was like, you are the opposite of what you are now. You were like shy. You came in New York from New Jersey on a bus and you were like shaking, like, I've never been here by myself. And not this kind of ballsy person that I am now. And I'm like, hi, I'm here. And they're like, who are you? And I was like, I'm supposed to start today. And they said, start what? We don't know who you are.
That must have felt good.
Yeah, it was kind of weird. I was like, well, that was quick.
What was your role at Fox?
I was, God, I don't even know what you would call it. It was almost like producer training program kind of a thing where they had me do voiceover recordings with all the talent. And back then, all the ratings came through in paper. Oh my God, I'm so dating myself now. Distributing information. And then what sprung into my next job was that the head of the station of Fox in New York City, his right-hand woman would go away every once in a while. They need somebody to replace her to sit there and kind of manage his schedule and stuff. And I was like, I'll do it. I would just jump in with both feet and just handled his schedule like there's no tomorrow, like there was not a missed beat, missed meeting, missed anything. And you think that's not that big of a deal, but he noticed that I was that capable and said, what the hell are you doing sitting here? Because at the time, obviously, if I'm going to take 13 years to graduate college, I was older than the other people in this training program. And he's like, we got to get you out of here. And so I just started going and looking for other jobs. And he said, I'm going to find you somewhere. I know this company who needs production coordinator over in the sports department. And I'm just going to call them. And he called for me and said, you need to hire her. She's amazing. And they did. And then I jumped out of the training right to coordinating on 24 shows a year. I mean, it was for this production company that worked solely for ESPN. It was quite the trial by fire. If I didn't have sort of street smarts, I would have failed miserably because at smaller production companies, they don't show you what to do. They go, I have a lot to do here. Go figure that out. Make sure that that guy gets over there to film that at this day. You got that? Goodbye. It's kind of been like a pattern to me.
Wow. Well, I mean, there's already a pattern emerging, transformative encounters, first with the professor at Brevard, then this person who gets you this amazing job, which is incredible. And I'm sure there's going to be a few more of those. But I'm curious, when you first had your production role, the taste of production, did you love it right away?
You know what? I did. It's like putting together the most epic, stressful puzzle you'll ever have to do. And I live very well in that space. And so that led me into live sports. And live sports, you have to be cut from a certain cloth to handle live sports. It is the best training ground. They respect you so much. Great pay. There's no, I mean, not to say that there's not backstories to it because there is to anything, but it was a great opportunity to learn things in a pace where you better think, not just on the fly, but 10 steps on the fly, 10 steps ahead on the fly. I loved it. I loved the people. I tend to be very high energy and I have caffeine. I'm very high strung. That kind of atmosphere is where all those people live. You can't be mellow. I've seen people come and go in like a week. It just is very difficult, but that's kind of the path that I just kept falling in that direction. And I loved it. I loved it.
Amazing. What is the difference then between live action or sports and the differences for those who don't know to produce one or the other?
Goodness, it's night and day. So being on the team who produces live, it's all prep. There's small things that are happening afterwards that might be like packaging material for another show or something like that. But all your prep happens while you're going to the show, and then everything is recorded as it's going. So people are pretty familiar with football or baseball. As you're watching the live show, it is what it is. Somebody says something you're not supposed to, it's live. The truck goes down or camera doesn't work, you're live. When you're going to tape, you can redo things. I remember when I first came out of sports and I did my first show that was outside of doing it in the moment. And the producers were interviewing me and they're like, can you handle three cameras? And I'm like, well, yeah, I've done way more than that. And then they're like, and it's taped. You mean like it's not live? Like you got to tape it? And they're like, yeah, it's due to my sleep. So taping something means the biggest thing about it is that you can redo it. If the audio isn't good, you can go back and do it again. Or if somebody doesn't say something the way you want them to, you can redo it. And that's all genres across the board, scripted, reality, hopefully not documentaries too much. Because of course, I'm a purist. I like to see docs like in the moment. But even that voiceover stuff like that, they can be redone. So there's a big difference between the two.
You mentioned you learned a lot doing the live sports one. Was the stressful environment something that you thrived on, or was it something you just dealt with?
That's a tough one, because when you're in it and you don't really understand that you're there. And then when you're done with it, you're like, oh God, oh no, like I'm going to breathe. My shoulders were like up by my ears the entire 10 years or however long it was. And then after a while, a lot of people do burn out. It's very stressful. But yeah, I mean, I don't think when I was doing it, you hate like last minute stuff when somebody drops out of a show and you got to replace them and you're up until 3 a.m. on a Friday before the show. That always stinks when you're doing that. But you feel very proud of yourself or your team or people who are around you for getting the things done that need to be done by that deadline.
So looking at your background in terms of places you've worked and brands you've worked with, it's spanned everything from HBO and Showtime to the Fab Five and UFC Primetime and on and on and on. What prompted you to move to different companies or work with different brands? And when did you know, let's work somewhere different or let's work on this new project? Or what helped you say, I've decided this is the time for me to move on?
I'll tell you a funny story. When I went to go to HBO from the production company I was at right out of Fox, I will tell your listeners, like, I wanted that job so bad that I stalked HBO. They almost had to hire me just to get me to go away. I must have done everything short of send them flowers to HR, like every single site, every single everything, every mailed the resume, called them, faxed, because that's how, you know, that's how it was in the early 2000s. And then there was a little bit of, after a couple of years or a number of years, there was a little bit of a shakeup where some people were leaving. And one happened to be one of my direct bosses who I just felt was such an inspiration to me and was so good to me that I thought that it was time to move when he was going to move as well. So I did not go where he went. I went out and went independent. And so that's how I ended up being on a number of different kinds of projects, because people would come and hire me as a line producer for doc series or documentary features like the Fab Five, and even Xbox when they went to do their first television show ever. And last television show ever. So I don't know if I should even talk about that. But they brought me in to do rights and clearances, which is something that you have to do diligently when you're putting a documentary together. So I would come onto projects in different capacities, whether it's full-on producer all the way through to consulting and producing for Xbox directly, so that the production company that was putting their show on wasn't going to mess up their legal side. It goes back to being a producer and what the definition of a producer is. There's so much to know. There's so much legal. There's so much finance. There's so much creativity. There's so many connections you need to know. It's a really hard position. Just somebody says, I'm a producer, and then you know exactly what they do. It's really, really difficult because it could mean 10 different things.
Sounds like a product manager in tech where I forget the saying that you said earlier, but it's the hardest, most stressful puzzle to complete. And yet somehow you end up being a jack of all trades. What did you do after Microsoft?
I think after Xbox, I did.
I only asked because I was looking at your profile, but it shows from there to Solaris and then from Solaris to Firestarter.
Oh, goodness. We're missing a chunk in there. Okay. And that IO then. Yeah, because after Xbox, I collaborated with a great director on lots of shows for the UFC. And so I was his producer and he was the director. And we teamed up on everything from UFC Primetime, which was their very unique show where we went in the field, shot and edited sort of on the fly and delivered in the training camps of the fighters as they were training. So it was like week to week to week to week doing the episodes. No, like shooting everything. Standard is you shoot everything up front and then you take it into the edit and then you edit it afterwards. This was kind of all on the fly, all in the field, the editors in the field. And it was pretty remarkable. It was fantastic. Like, I love being around the fighters. It's funny, in sports, I never really felt like the girl. I was just one of the people that there wasn't like, she's the girl or you're one of the guys. Like, I never really heard that stuff. And the fighters were super respectful and it was a great experience. And then after that, we took the show all the way. It started out on Spike and it went all the way to Fox. And then it ended up there, landed on Fox, and everybody was just super thrilled to get it to that level. And then after that, I don't know. I met a producer named Greg O'Connor, who was the owner and an extraordinary producer for a company called Solaris Entertainment. They've done movies like Warrior and Pride and Glory. They get Oscar nominations. I mean, their stuff is very, very emotional, very heavy quality, fantastic stuff. And I said, all right, I'm done with sports for a while. I want to learn more from you. He and I were collaborating on a project already. That's how I had met him, that I was collaborating with him through a director that we both knew. And then I just said, I want to become a part of your company. Teach me everything you got. And he was 100% for it, treated me like an equal, was pretty spectacular in terms of bringing me into meetings so I could learn the difference between what I was doing live television and film, which are totally different. The terminology is different. The finance is different. The finance on a film, I'm still to this day constantly watching, reading, learning about waterfalls and finance structures and how to put together a movie is like, every single one of them is different. Every single way to do it is different. And so that's how I ended up at Solaris Entertainment, is just being hungry to learn something totally different. Still in the same area, but something completely different, and still utilize all the knowledge I had as a line producer. And I'm a doer. I don't tell you I'm going to do something and then not do it. That would crush me to have somebody think that of me. That's, you know, a little bit of ego there, but I think that he and his partner saw that I was that kind of person that was going to figure out what I needed to know and not be a burden on anybody, but actually be a benefit. So it was pretty spectacular to get that opportunity.
Well, it's clear that you have a very curious mindset and you're not only a doer, but you execute well, because a lot of people do, but it might not be the highest quality. So that's also in conjunction to that. So you've done sports, you've done live action, you went from TV then to film. Did you gravitate more towards film after you've learned that, or did you just realize it's different and you like both?
You know what? I kind of like both. I like everything that I've tried when it comes to media. One of the greatest things about starting my own company coming off of Solaris was choosing my own projects and deciding I wanted to be a director. I've always wanted to be a director. A lot of the classes I took in school when I thought I was going to go into music were directing for television or directing for film. And I loved it, not just the creativity, but all the decisions that you have to make. You have to have that kind of personality to have all the people follow you in your creative decisions and not screw the budget, and you own your company. It's also hard. It's a whole nother level of record keeping and HR and all kinds of crazy stuff. But I was able to go from all the knowledge that I learned from all the different mediums that I've worked in, what kind of director I wanted to be. And so I carried that out of learning so much that I learned from Greg in Solaris, carried that forward into Firestarter, and just really said to my producing partner, I'm going to be a director from here on out. She was like, whatever, let's make it happen. So yeah, again, just serendipity being able to get in a position to start a company. Because in this industry, you can't just wake up one day and go, I'm going to be a director. Like, maybe I'm just delusional, but I made that my priority and pivoted us into that direction. And luckily, Kimberly, also my producing partner, was okay with it.
Incredible. So coming on July of this year, it'll be the 8th birthday for Firestarter. Can you describe to our listeners what your initial vision was for Firestarter? You had mentioned that you definitely wanted to be a director from that point forward, but can you describe more about Firestarter Studios?
It's funny you say 8th year. It was like roller coaster years, like lots of loops and stuff in there too, because there's a lot I didn't know. So the backstory to all of this is that eventually, so at the end of being with Solaris, I moved to Los Angeles and decided I wanted to try more kinds of content, but still be attached to Solaris Entertainment. So we started Solaris Media Group on the West Coast, which was myself and my current long-term producing partner, Kimberly Austin. We decided we were going to do things like online video and branded video and comedies, because the stuff at Solaris was so good and so poignant, but it's a lot of heavy subjects. And so while we were out here, I'm so lucky to have a producing partner and a business partner that just goes, run with it. Because I have 20 ideas a day. I either burn out on all of them or I take 2 years and I make a business plan and I say, this is what we're doing. And she's like, great. I say to her, we need to acquire a bigger company and merge it with Solaris Media Group, disconnect from Solaris and try to do our own thing. Now, I knew nothing about mergers or acquisitions to the tune of nothing. Like, I'm talking, I would talk to the SBDC and the SBA and talk to them about what happens when you buy in a company and loans and financing and all that kind of stuff. And luckily for me, Kimberly and I were in a position where we could go out and buy a company. So we find Firestarter videos. Firestarter videos was all animation. It was all branded content. It was all B2B. And here we are, a creative company that is making all original content, has nothing to do with brands, has nothing to do with animation. And I was like, look how much money they're making. We'll be great. So we, in 2015, acquire Firestarter Videos. We cut the deal. Everything is great. And then we jump in with both feet. At that current moment, we get the largest contract we've ever had for Solaris Media Group and the largest contract that we've ever had for Firestarter Videos. So Kimberly and I are more than underwater with producing two epic projects and figuring out what Firestarter Videos even does and setting up a bank account, like the basic stuff, and figuring out what we're doing with Solaris Media Group. And it turned into the most colossal mess I've ever not understood that could happen in business. It was everything. We had to have somebody come in and help us put the companies together because the cultures didn't match. And like, you know, you're like, whatever, man, just everybody be nice. What it means, right? And then finance, Kimberly's now managing two sets of accountants and two books and two taxes and two everythings. And so eventually, we knew we had to make everybody into one company. We created Firestarter Studios. Everybody get along staff-wise. You're now a part of this company. And then we had a new group of issues like, okay, so this company technically started in 2015. What about the employees that were from last couple of years? Where does their anniversary start? All these things that we just had to shake out that we didn't know. And along the way, even found out that there were $250,000 worth of non-completed projects on the books for Firestarter Videos that the money was transferred out. So lesson learned. Yeah, it took us about 3 years to get everything straight financially. It was pay everybody else before us, make sure the employees don't leave. Such a lesson in, oops. Like, Kimberly does all the worry. She does all the worry. I'm just like, what's next? What's the next problem? Micro issues. That problem is in front of me today. Let's get done with that. Let's move on to the next. Where she will think about the whole nine yards of, oh my God, what do we do?
Oh my gosh.
Honestly, like complete opposites, but the best compliments, because she would take care of everything financially and say, okay, where are we here? And that would give me the opportunity to look at things globally and say, XYZ, we need this to go here. We need this here. We need this sale here, that sale there. So it was out of love, out of wanting to be independent, out of wanting to not work with, there are a lot of jerks out there. We have the autonomy to say, no, thank you. We don't want to work with somebody who is mean on the initial call.
You'd think that's like such a low bar, but it sounds like that happens not infrequently.
Right. It does. Or the project is so glorious and you're so excited about it, but the people are awful and you don't realize that that is 90% of it, that your project will not be glorious.
Right.
During it will be awful.
Well, it's amazing that you mentioned it took 3 years to iron out all those wrinkles. I thought you were going to say 3 months, 3 quarters, but 3 years is quite a test. And so testament to you and your partner for sticking through it, and also a testament to your relationship, your both friendship and also your professional working relationship. And so what kind of projects does Firestarter do today?
Currently, we're working on two feature films, two feature documentaries. One is on the history of suicide on the Golden Gate Bridge. The other one is on Indigenous language preservation. We kind of say at Firestarter that we have two different sides that keep us completely sane. One side is just epically serious topics, as the two that I just said just then. And we take them very seriously, and we are ethical and storytellers with collaboration of the person's story, because it's their story, it's not ours. We don't change words. We don't do all that stuff that is very infamous in our industry. And then our other side is branded and it's quirky and it's weird and it's fun. And so we bounce back and forth between the two. And we're like, you do too much quirky, nutty stuff, and you're like, eh, you get bored. But then if you do too much serious stuff, you just get down. Like, you're just totally down. So we've ended in two polar opposites being our sweet spots, which don't complement each other. You wouldn't think that's where we would end up being, but that's what we do. On our branded side, we do a lot of media. It could be animation, it could be live action, for everything from commercial work to brand series. So if a brand wants to do something that's not just a flat out commercial, they might want to do something a little bit more long term, like a series that might be on their website or YouTube channel. And then over the pandemic, as production was gone, we ramped up fairly quickly and jumped into the e-learning space in a way that was unique for us, because we brought things to those projects that were super unique. We shot customer service like Wes Anderson. Who's going to pay me to shoot like Wes Anderson? Nobody. So that was a project that we took because I wanted to stretch my wings as a director and just have a great time and get the company back in. But it turned out to be some pretty fantastic media that we made, fantastic project, just great stuff.
I love that.
But that's us. That's us. We are able to take things one at a time and make the decision of whether or not we want to do that project by project. It's a unique place to be, but it's what we wanted to do with our lives, not just be stressed for money.
On your website, Firestarter Studios says that you create exceptional and unique content. And I feel like everyone will say that, but how do you guys do that? How do you describe that creative process?
We started with that catchphrase after, like, I'm a workshop fanatic. Like, I will go to anybody's work. You're going to teach me how to do something I don't know. I want to sit through your webinar, your workshop, your whatever. I love it. I want to learn. I don't really learn that well, especially because my brain, just reading a book. I want some sort of interaction. So I was watching, it was recommended to us through this program that we watched this clip that was like from the 80s. And all of us were like, such an old clip. But it was a Harvard professor talking about how, stop saying you make the best. Stop saying you're the best, because it's subjective. So if you're a car maker and I want a minivan and you make Ferraris, Ferrari may not be the best. It kind of still is, but maybe not in that instance. So I started to think about, how does that reflect on us? I will never go out there and say that we're the best. We're not. We may be the best in some aspect, but everybody can be the best in some aspect. So we wanted to focus on something that would be completely opposite of, I'm always the best. So we're very unique in many ways. We're the only company in the country that is an independent company to be nominated for the Primetime Emmy in short form docs. We're it. It's us, NBC, History Channel, Netflix, big guns in us. We also make it a very, very big point to hire female creatives. We're a certified woman-owned company, and I like to give opportunities where there might not be one. And I don't go out and say, oh, she's got boobs, hire her. Like, that's not what I want somebody to say for me. But I want to cultivate enough opportunities for people that if I'm looking across the boards at resumes, they have a chance to rise to the top. And a lot of times they do. And then we're those two buckets. God, I hate that word bucket. Silos. I don't know, whatever kitschy word you want to put in there. Super serious, but ethical, which we find those two don't usually go together a lot of times. And we're quirky. So if you want one of those two, you know, at least that if you put your trust in us as a company, we make sure that one of our standards is you get treated well. We're not going to screw you in the end. We don't overbill for talking to me on the phone. It's like, we just don't want to be that company. We just want to be a company that our clients like to come back to a lot of times because they enjoy working with us. Our clients have had us for years and they take us to other companies and they take us to other places. And that's kind of what we decided was going to be sort of our unique. Our clients kind of know what they want, and we will spin it out as weird or wacky or serious as they want it. But ultimately, they have the ability to tell us, okay, you went to the moon, let's bring it back to the rooftop.
Yeah, I love that.
That's kind of how we do things uniquely.
You also mentioned we don't make cheap shit.
I just made you say shit.
I know. Of all the slogans and taglines, I'm sure you're very precise and deliberate with word choice. Why that tagline?
We have, in our industry, that's especially in the branded space, it's difficult, and there's a giant Grand Canyon-sized space between our client and what we do in pricing. It was on a day, I think, that I was just frustrated. Somebody called and said, I really want to hire you guys. We have $6 and we want you to make Star Wars. But it was a combination of things. We have a saying at Firestarter, and it's all over the place. And it's, you can get it fast, cheap, or good. You get two. And I was tired of people picking the wrong. They're like, we want it good and cheap. You know, like, it ain't going to happen. Do you want to be represented in media, in your visual? Crappy. I'm super proud of everything I do. From the tiniest little project that we take on, we for a while did all the social media for the World Food Program and Nobel Peace Prize, largest NGO, like feed people. I make media that shows that you feed people. So when we do any project across the board, we just want it to be the best it can. And we're very honest about what we can and cannot do. We've gotten a lot of great feedback on that tagline that people understand right away. Like, don't come to us if you're looking for the person who's going to do it for you cheaply. We have professionals. We are professionals, professional storytellers. We take a lot of pride in what we do. And it just came out of that, of like, throwing up the papers and being like, I'm tired of it. I don't make cheap shit. That was it. And then I was like, oh, Kimberly, I was like, I'm putting it on the website.
I love the fast, cheap, or good pick two. You can only have two of the three, but it reminds me of the saying, you can have it all, but not at the same time. So when people are talking about health and fitness and professional and personal, you can have it all. Just you literally can't integrate all those things at once. And so something has to give. You had mentioned that every project you've done, you've been so proud of, whether it's small or big. Has there ever been a project that you absolutely adored, that you spent a lot of time and mindshare and you loved it, but the response on the other end was not as glowing?
That's a funny one. Project-wise, I would say that we have had clients, and I won't name names, we have had clients where we have thought we have done the most exquisite work, and then they come in and their edits make it worse. Or we do a graphics package that is so strong and unique and fantastic, and they want it to look more like a PowerPoint. And we're like, what? I would say even to top that is, you know, you and I were talking about our foray into VR. I put so much work into that. We had the greatest team and we tried so hard to jump 2 feet into VR and failed so epically that it was just crushing. I was like, how is that even possible that we did so badly at the attempt? I just think that it was a medium that we understood, but there were people that were in it that were so good and so strong that they were the go-tos. And I would even go to them. Like, why would you come to me? I'm just starting out. I tried so hard to get us into that space and it just never materialized. It was crushing. It was crushing. It was also like a revenue stream that I was like, hey, look, we're going to make money in VR, which nobody still knows how to make money in VR. So the idea that I thought just out of the gate that I would be the one to crack that nut was insane. But I'd say probably those two, one on the business side and one on the project side, kind of heartbreaking.
Before starting Fire Studios, you really wanted to be a director. Do you switch now back and forth, or did you commit to being a director?
I still produce. I still have to produce, really, because as being one of the owners, I love it. There are certain things about being a director that I absolutely love. It's creativity. It's putting together something from nothing. But at the same time, producing, it's making sure things happen. And so sometimes I can't really get away from making the call to the person that I might know better than somebody else. Or I keep saying in the beginning of a project, I don't want to produce it. I just want to direct it. And then I still like peek my head in. I'm like, you guys even need anything from me? Can I start you a spreadsheet? It's like, get out of here. And I'm like, oh, come on.
I love it.
I think you're born, once you're a producer, you're always a producer. You're a problem solver. You're creative at fixing things on the fly or coming up with solutions. And it's just sort of ingrained in you. You can't really fully walk away from it.
I love it. Well, I'll make sure to put Firestarter Studios a link on the show notes so that people can check it out. And then I'll pivot to the questions I ask everyone, starting with who or what inspires you?
Who inspires me a lot are producers who have come before me that are mega producers, but who have answered my questions or talked to me. I am so impressed with them. And I'm talking about Gail Ann Hurd or Marshall Hershkovitz or Mark Gordon, these big, big producers who I have met through the years in various settings that I've asked questions and kept in touch with. And they were just gracious. And they're the most inspiring people, especially Gail Ann Hurd. We would say in the office, what would Gail do? You know, just try to figure out if we can get a problem solved. So Kimberly was scared when Gail bought a restaurant. She thought I was going to go out and buy a restaurant. But instead, we bought a soundstage. So there's that. We're putting together the first female-owned certified soundstage in Los Angeles. So I find inspiration from the oddest places. Like, I went to a convention, WeBank convention, which is Women Business Enterprise National Chapter, I think, a couple weeks ago in Tennessee. And I met some business owners that just blew me away by what they knew and I needed to know. And I learned a lot from them. So, and these were women who had tiny micro businesses. They just were crazy smart. Even somebody like yourself getting to geek out on finance and recommending that I read these great books. It was inspiring to me to go down a path that I wouldn't go to before. So I don't know. I try to find inspiration all over the place. I did my life backwards. So I have young twins. And so seeing things that they see in a different way, like even YouTube, I'm like, YouTube's going to take over the planet. There'll be no Netflix. There's going to, like, my kids don't want to watch Netflix. They groan. So even things that I do in my career of seeing how the future could pivot towards something as major as YouTube being the standard platform, ripping off inspiration from 2 10-year-olds. One person that I want to mention too is another inspiration to me is a woman named Catherine Grooms. She works at the SBDC, which is the Small Business Development Center, which is often overlooked by people who are in business as a resource to help you keep yourself from failing atomically. I have met with her now for the past 6 years. I've advised with them for 8 years before I bought the business, but I meet with her every week and she says, what's going on? And I tell her, and she gets so excited about stuff and stays quiet when I'm worried or gives a little advice. But that kind of pure cheerleader, she's got no stake in the company. Not my buddy. We don't go have drinks. But that kind of pure excitement for those tiny little milestones is so important that I have to give a shout out to her. She really keeps me sane. She's even a little bit of a, I call her a marriage counselor, because my business partner and I, even if she and I get into a disagreement about something, I have a little backup that is completely non-biased. Not like a friend would be like, it's all you, you're great. She's very honest. So I think everybody should find out who that person is, especially, man, when you're in business, there can be some decisions that you don't know that you're going down the wrong road. Like what we did, we had no idea.
Did you have a mentor or role model?
I've had a couple of mentors and a couple of role models. Definitely the three that I just mentioned. I think Gail Ann Hurd was a tremendous mentor towards me. We worked together on the Produce By conference for the Producers Guild of America. And my very first encounter with her was, I don't know what I was thinking. I was stupid. We were starting to co-chair the conference together and I had created it and figured that she was going to be a figurehead, the big calls, you know, call the people that she needed to call to come in there. And so we had a simple thing that came through for an email and asked us to write up a little blurb about it. And I just quickly wrote it up and sent it out. And the next thing I knew, I got a call from, at the time, the executive director of the Producers Guild saying, what did you just do to Gail? Like, she is fuming. And I was so freaked out. And I was like, you got to get her on the phone. I have to get her on the phone. First of all, she taught me a life lesson. She got on the phone with me and listened to why I did what I did. Then she said, I understand. Then she explained her role and what she was bringing to the table and said, don't for 1 second think that I'm not going to come in on this just like you are. and said, "You're fantastic. We're going to start this great partnership and everything is great." And so as a role model, that was one thing that, especially when I talked to my employees, that I always remembered, that she was just in the moment gracious and not, she didn't scream or what I was used to in sports. Some of these people are yellers. And then I would say one of my greatest mentors was a man named David Picker out of New York, who, you look him up, is just one of the most powerful icons in the entertainment industry. President of all the studios at one point and United Artists, and was producer for movies like The Jerk and Steve Martin and Woody Allen, and just a tremendous, wonderful, warm, fantastic man. And I would meet up with him every once in a while and just be like, "This is what's happening." And he would just give me little guidance. And he would say, "All right, tornado, go down here, accelerate there. Super proud of you. Go." Like, and he was very grounding. He's done it all. He had really done every pinnacle position that you could get to, and still was, everybody who met him loved him, walked away with the same kind of positive, wonderful adjectives about him. And so I keep that close to me too, because his eye contact, the way he would look like he was only cared about your conversation, those things I learned from him. And want people, like, so many people said amazing things when he passed away, and it's what I want to happen to me. I want those amazing things, not like this big just career, but also to have people genuinely enjoy having a conversation with you.
Well, I'm pretty sure you're well on your way if you don't already have people saying, "What would Rachel Klein do?" or having the same feelings. But it sounds so fortunate of the people and the role models you had in your life. I'm curious, what does success mean for you? And that could be answered personally or professionally with projects or both.
I have a couple of different success things that would be great for me. And then my kids that grow up successfully and happy. One of my sons already wants to be an animator. I'm like, "Chop, chop, man. I can put you to work. Like, can you by next week?" They're happy and doing stuff that they really enjoy and not just out schlubbing away at a job. Professionally, I want more passion projects and more genuinely to enjoy the people that I work with. I have a group of people that I work with and I direct every time, and we have such a good time at it. Doesn't matter whether it's a very heavy subject or light and goofy. We keep each other very grounded and we're like family. And I would like that continue. One of the biggest success stories for me, I just want to employ everybody. I want to get everybody jobs. I want to make sure everybody works. I'm constantly trying to find more projects for the studio so that I can bring in those people that have worked with me and make sure that they're constantly working. And then personally, I want to retire in Hawaii. That's like, everybody who works really knows, like, what's going to happen? Beach in Hawaii. I've already talked to my kids. They're going to go to University of Hawaii. Like, I started slipping brochures in their lunchboxes at 10. Have a great life. And at the end, know when to stop. Have enough time to just enjoy it all. Not really have to work myself to death.
Yeah, well, I mean, it sounds like you work a lot, but that you love it. And so it's that perfect dream of, once you find your passion, you're not really working a day in your life, even though it is technically work. We talked about this a little bit in terms of the VR experience, but I'll just ask it directly. What is your most transformative failure turned into growth moment? And whether it was that VR expansion or attempted expansion, but what can you share with listeners about the failure moment that really was a greatest growth moment for you?
Oh, it's not even the VR. I would say it was the buying of Firestarter Studios, that things just kept getting worse and worse. And no matter how many webinars I took, I had a team of advisors. I mean, everybody was just chucking in all together. But there was one person, because I will not fail at that level. Like, that was a level failure that was like, there goes the house. It was epic failure. There was one of our advisors who was working with us on accounting. And he called me a Pollyanna and said, "If you don't stop your positive outlook, you're going to be out of business in 3 months. And I was like, "I'm going to drop the F-bomb in this show." Like, that, I was so offended and so angry that to this day, this is 5 years later, to this day, many of my advisors, I will look at them and go, "Don't you talk to me like Charlie." Like, that was his name. And every time I have another success and another success, I bring it up and I'm like, "Told you, Charlie."
Well, Catherine sounds incredibly special, just to be objective, but also a complete support system for you. But I'm curious, so you'd mentioned that it was awful for many years in the beginning. How bad was it? Or can you describe some of the things you mentioned, culture and transitioning from the M&A of like the two companies, but how bad was it? Like, if you can describe some detail.
It was everything from, let's say, who's your ideal customer? We had no idea because nothing was the same, all the way through watching it year to year, just the revenue tank, just crash and burn. It's not only stressful from a financial standpoint, but a personal standpoint of knowing what everything is tied to this merger and this acquisition and how it's like, even my business partner was like, why did I follow you into this mess? Like, it was a lot. It did get pretty bad, but we knew that if we would completely take the emotion away and sit down and look at finance only and figure out how to take care of our employees the best we could. I mean, we would do stuff like movie day, where we'd take the employees all out to the movies. Just be like, walk out. Don't worry about it. People could take off to get their hair done. I mean, it was like, we couldn't afford to give them extra days or a raise or something like that. But we made sure that they had, like, bring your dog, do whatever you got to do, work from home 10 days, whatever, to make up for it so that they would stay happy. And then we didn't pay ourselves, because the bills don't go away when you find out that there's a lot of projects on the books that need to get completed that there's no money for. So when we hit the bottom and started coming back up, it was scary and remarkable and fantastic, and we learned a lot. But we keep looking back. I'll say the scariest part is that we keep looking back at that point and saying, that could happen tomorrow. Like, right? Like, that was scary. That was very scary. But we didn't know. I cannot stress enough in small business the strength of finance. People just say, I'm good at what I do, or I make a project that's really awesome. Like, great, you're gonna drive yourself on the ground, because you don't understand that the basic building blocks are, it's a financial model at the end of the day.
I always use this analogy in asset management when people are launching their new funds, whether it's hedge funds or whatever new company it is. But I always say it's like a restaurant where you could have the best portfolio manager that has the best stock picker. It doesn't matter at the end of the day if you don't have a great infrastructure, a COO, a CFO, ultimately the people who run the business. And 9 out of 10 fail, it's not from the food being bad, because generally the restaurant opened because the chef was great. It's all the other stuff. And so it all is really in the line production role, like making sure operationally that it is sound. I'm curious, after year three, what was the inflection point? Was it just randomly it kind of ticked back up, or what caused it to finally inflect positively for you guys?
It was a combination of a number of things. One was finally getting out from figuring out what was going on with those projects, because the books just kept getting sucked. And we were like, what is happening? But then it was also structuring Firestar Studios to become its own entity. So we were no longer trying to put two together to make one. We were no longer trying to put this culture and this culture and try to figure out what they were doing. We also had to spend money that we didn't have to spend again. We brought in a branding specialist who used to run Disney International to sort of figure out what do we do here? How do we come up with the marketing so that we can get some sales? So it was just the perfect storm of all of that we had gone through 3 years. And then that third year, the fourth year, revenue doubled. So it kind of hit the bottom and then just never looked back. But that bottom was like, damn. It was like
close to rock bottom, it sounds like.
Maybe I should have got a job. Or, you know, Kimberly and I were like, should we be doing Uber on the side? It was scary. It was very scary. But I think once you dissect all the pieces and start to look at things in terms of finance, you can very easily figure out what's going on. But we weren't doing that. We were looking at everything else. So it was an interesting exercise. And my dad passed away about 10 years ago, and my aunt and uncle decided they were going to be my surrogate dad now. So they come in and with their Brooklyn accent now and like yell at me. I don't know. But my uncle had said, no business is a true business until after year 5. And so it was literally like on the day of 5 that we had completely bounced back. And Kimberly calls me and goes, call him and tell him it's our 5th year. We're telling him the whole time through the 5 years, like, we're a real company. And he's like, yeah, you're a real boy. Not hardly.
If you could speak to Rachel right after college, what would you tell her?
Oh my gosh. Become a lawyer. You'll save so much money. Kimberly and I always joke because we have like 20 different lawyers. They do 20 different things. We have our tax lawyer, our employment lawyer, our litigation lawyer, because everybody in content litigates everything. And so my mom ever listens to this, she's going to go, I told you so. And I'll say, yeah, you were right. After college, I should have done it. My mom used to send me mugs at Brevard that said, lawyers do it in their brief. And I'm like, Mom, I'm not going to be a lawyer. I should have. It's like one of the only things in the whole wide world, I would say, that actually helps you be a better producer. You write your own contracts.
Well, I'm going to get you a mug after the show, and it's going to be like, I am Pollyanna. Last question. What's next for Rachel Klein?
Oh, my God. I want to direct a feature. I should be more specific, like a feature that's not a documentary, because I am directing two feature documentaries now. But I would love to direct a feature film. And that's sort of where I'm leading towards now. So that's a big accomplishment and a big goal for myself. Company-wise, I just want to be a disruptor somehow. I might, you know, Kimberly laughs. She's like, we're going to just do right on your tombstone, disruptor. And I'm like, yeah. I just want to think ahead and think big, like the female-owned soundstage. Venture capitalists give 2% to women. So we bootstrap this sucker. And it's like when a door costs more to get it, something else doesn't get bought. It's not like we go to somebody and say, we need more money. So I think to launch for the company, to launch this stage, have it be wildly successful, have 50 venture capitalists come after me and say, man, we should have invested in women a long time ago. that's next. That's the small goal, right?
I love it. Well, going to your bigger goal, what kind of film or feature do you want to direct? Any genre, any theme in particular?
I have a horror comedy script right now that I'm dying to make. It's so ridiculously funny and gory at the same time. To me, I see like women directing Little Women and Emma, and they have a lot of good opportunities in television, but even the feature films, I feel like where are the women who are directing Marvel that isn't Captain Marvel?
Yeah. Amazing. Well, Rachel, I had a blast in this conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This is really fun.